Good afternoon, everybody. This is Rabih Ayyub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode that today we're recording. And I have the honor and the pleasure and the distinct pleasure to have with me Mario Krivokovic. Sorry, Mario, I bastardized your last name there. Mario Krivokovic. I got to do it like two, three times. Sorry, guys.
Krivokovic. It's a little bit difficult to pronounce.
Sorry about that. Eastern European names is always, you know, catches me, and I'm very sorry. And I'm going to leave this in because I want to see how, I want to tell the audience how difficult it is to pronounce these names. And you know, it's not easy. Sometimes we take it for granted, you know, the Smith last name and all these names, but you got to get used to, you know, in a globalization type of world, in the global world, to pronounce different names. I mean, you go to different places around the world, and people don't have the same names, and we need to get used to that. So I appreciate you with me, and sorry about pronouncing your last name.
Oh, good, man. Don't worry about it.
I tried. Before we get started, Mario, welcome to the channel, and I'm glad you took the time with me. Mario is an executive coach who coached in Fortune 500 companies, etc. And Mario is a well-known person in that space. He coached companies in various ecosystems of our journey from a sales perspective and from, you know, developing those companies, thinking on the inside, try to figure out, you know, how they behave, how they think, et cetera. And I think it's very important dialogue to have that insight look on the way the process work from inside of those organizations, from somebody who's looking from the outside in, not knowing how these things function. So before we dive into the topic of the hour, would you mind take us through your journey? And if you don't mind, use that time for your introduction.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. My journey begins, I'm a child of the 80s, grow up in what was former Yugoslavia, you know, during the 90s, if any one of your viewers remembers what was happening, you know, here in Balkans. And then early 2000s, during a student exchange program, I spent 3 years in the United States. I got back. I lived a little bit in Berlin, then moved back to Serbia, then got back to Berlin. And, you know, I kind of moved around, currently living in Berlin. So my background is sales and revenue. I got four companies scaled them from 1 to 10 million in annual recurring revenue. I got one company to 100 million in revenue. But my fascination was always with developing my team and people who were kind of direct reports to me, right? So I obsessed over how do I become like a better leader coach. So I got into, you know, NLP and PCM and the art and science of coaching and so on. And that led me to 2014, where I met probably one of the top three executive coaches in the world, Robert Hargrove. He wrote a book in 1995 called Masterful Coaching. I was really a fan of the book. I read it like three or four times. So I contacted him, and then him and I created a partnership. He currently resides in Boston, Massachusetts. Well, a city near Boston, Waltham, where we work, you know, with Fortune 500 executives. But it's not your, you know, standard coaching. What we do is actually business coaching, which is kind of, you know, a little bit different. We focus on the impossible future, on business outcomes, you know, and creating extraordinary results. That's kind of our focus. And I would say my background being a VP sales / chief revenue officer really, really helped me getting
into the coaching.
Getting into that specific area of coaching.
Exactly. So the specific area, like for those, you know, who are, you know, we hear a lot about coaching. I mean, you don't open LinkedIn nowadays unless you see like somebody who's, you know, I've received messages about coaching on a single day, probably 10 of them on an average. For those who are listening to the podcast today, would you mind, you know, zooming in on, you know, the various types of coaching and the one that you specialize in?
Yeah. So Okay, just if it's okay, Robin, a little bit of history, right? So coaching, the coaching we do it, it has its roots in sports. And you have the main goal of coaching, what we do is winning, right? Winning, specifically winning in business. Now, in 70s, 80s, there was a big influx of, you know, especially, well, it began after World War II, but let's say 60s and 70s kind of prevalent, the rise of psychology and psychiatry, right? And those two kind of disciplines crept into coaching, you know, when, you know, with the some of the governing bodies like ICF and all of those. And that kind of gave rise to, you know, developmental coaching, relationship coaching, and so on. But it kind of all got mixed up, right? And then, you know, at one point, phenomenal executives, phenomenal leaders who got these certificates couldn't, for some reason, give advice, which was kind of against all of that. But, you know, what Robert and I actually do is we do have skin in the game. We walk alongside of the executives and the CEOs to help them achieve that impossible future, whether it's, you know, a breakthrough technology, whether it's 10xing their business in 3 to 5 years, whatever it is. So that's kind of our focus. And to differentiate, we call it business coaching because everything else is, you know, either relationships or, you know, leadership or developmental or whatever it is. Nothing wrong with that. It just, this is how we do it, and we do it differently than what they do.
And Mario, like for those who are on the, let's say, you know, some of your customers, why do you think they select you? Like, what is, as you know, the field is congested with that. But what makes what makes your service or your solution so special? I love the idea of walking through the process with your customers. Is there different? Is there other things, or just because you have a skin in the game and you're inside of the process? Yes.
So I got all of the other coaching certificates fairly early on. So I went through NLP, so both practitioner and master, NLP being neuro-linguistic programming, right? The origins, again, in psychiatry, created by Bandler and Grinder. Then I went into PCM, which was, you know, which is a communications model developed by NASA. Then the art and science of coaching, which is a coaching framework, but again, developed based on the work of Milton Erickson, who was a hypnotherapist, right? And I always found that, always found it very limiting.
Yeah.
From what I wanted to do, what I wanted to achieve. So I reached out to Robert, who was accomplished, and then he kind of opened my eyes on this business coaching. So the main reason I would say that CEOs work with me and Robert is result, is the attitude of winning.
That makes a big difference.
Right? Today, you know, HR has a list of competencies and they have, you know, this is what we want to achieve. You got to check the boxes. We don't care about that, especially when working with C-level executives in big companies. What do C-level people want? They want to win.
That's right.
This is why they're here. They have 5,000 people in their department. And they want to win. This is what we do.
I love that idea.
We are not support. You know, we are not. We don't hold their hands. We walk alongside of them to chase whatever the impossible future is that they want to achieve.
So. I love that idea because, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, every company, large organization, such as the one you deal with, they all have their, I would call them, you know, the barriers through HR processes. And you mentioned, you know, you don't probably go through that because I would assume a CEO or C-level executive that you're dealing with at that level, as you mentioned earlier, you know, they're interested in results, they're interested in winning, they're interested in breaking whatever the mold is, because the mold probably that you have right now did not get you to where you want to be. So you may want to break a few eggs in the process. How do, in your opinion, like since you were on the inside of that, how do CEO manage that? Like how do you manage going outside of the process, if you will. I mean, I don't know what you call it internally, and say, okay, we're throwing all this out as a CEO, and I'm going to go try the different something else and making sure that everybody's on board with that.
Great question. Well, the first thing is what I want to see whenever I talk with an executive or a CEO. What I mostly work with, to be perfectly honest, I mostly work with CEO's executive team. That's my specialty. Like I Robert is the CEO whisperer. He works with CEOs. I work with the executive team. The first thing I want to do is, where's your focus? Right? So there is a beautiful, beautiful saying. I keep forgetting who said it, but maybe bonus points for the listener who gets this quote.
Who comes up with it.
And that's, pay attention to what you're paying attention to.
Absolutely.
Phenomenal. So this is the first thing I want to do. Where's your focus? Are you, we call it, are you optimizing the present? Or you are creating, or past, same thing, or you're focusing on the future. So where is your focus? Optimization of the present or going to the future? And this is the first thing that I look at.
Yeah.
And then, okay, what is this breakthrough project? What is this breakthrough idea? What will, you know, if you accomplish this, what will make a whole lot of difference in the industry? And that kind of gets them going. It gets them actively excited. Oh, I can actually break through my day-to-day routines and, you know, to 12-hour days where I have like 16 meetings on like every half an hour. And I actually focus on creating something big and something.
So in your opinion, like, there are some people out there, I mean, some CEOs or some VPs or, you know, they're probably high ego kind of people, right? You know, they have a high personality and, you know, otherwise they wouldn't have gotten to where they are. So they probably think, hey, listen, you know, I can read a book or I can listen to a couple of podcasts and I can achieve what I want to achieve. Where do you draw the line on that one? What's your recommendation? You know, why would you not do this versus having somebody such as yourself and your partner guiding them through the process? What's the difference?
Excellent. Excellent question. Well, whenever we talk with either an executive or a CEO, the first thing that we want to assess, or what I want to assess at least, is, are you coachable? Like, can you take coaching, right?
But is that one of those stories, you know, you put a, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks?
It is a good example. In most, I would say you are correct when it comes to the ego part. And these guys are, you know, probably larger than life. But what the best of them realized is, if I have a coach that I can work with, I will be 2 times or 3 times or 5 times better. So it's most of these CEOs, they're not resistant to coaching, although it can maybe see, you know, you can maybe, oh, he's, you know, Fortune 100 CEO, no way he's been into coaching. Oh yeah, they are. Just need the right coach.
Yeah. Yeah. And does that put you in a friendship kind of a relationship at some point?
No, it puts you in a client coach relationship. It's a sacred.
You don't develop like a more connectivity with them.
Well, look, after a year, sure. You know, after 2 years.
Yeah, of course, not at the beginning.
Yeah, well, at the beginning, it's a partnership.
Of course.
Right? If you as a coach set yourself above the CEO, you're in deep trouble. And also, if a coach, if the CEO goes and, you know, positions himself or herself above you, there's not going to be any coaching.
That's right.
Right. So.
So Mario, I want to ask you, like, do you think like all the Fortune 500 CEOs today, or what's the percentage of them, they have a executive coach working with them today? Do you think there's a percentage of that? Or?
Oh, no, I know. The PwC did a extensive research on this, and over 60% of Fortune 500 CEOs do have a coach, and the rest want to have a coach. Just either it wasn't on their agenda or they didn't find one.
They didn't find the right one yet.
Yeah, yeah. Or it's not on their radar. Like, yeah, I know I should have a coach, but I just didn't get around to get it. But I think the number is around 60% of the Fortune 500.
Mario, I'm also so curious. I mean, a CEO at that level, they've got a lot of people in their circle, right? They've got a lot of friends. They've got a lot of employees.
Oh, good question. You would be surprised how few people are there around. Well, there are a lot of people in a sense that they're like an asteroid field, you know, small but not relevant. It's more like they have maybe four or five people in their vicinity that they are really close with. So his or her personal assistant and then the executive team. You know, either, you know, CFO, chief legal, chief revenue, chief technology. So that the core team, that's who the CEO is the closest to, right? Everyone else is fighting for the CEO's attention, but I found the best CEOs really know how to manage, one, their time, and two, their relationship.
So throughout your experience, Mario, I'm interested to find out as much as the audience is. Can you tell us a story where you've unlocked a breakthrough with your customer? And even for yourself, you must have learned from all these coaching, because coaching, I think it goes both ways. Yeah. You learn and they learn and, you create that ecosystem. Can you talk to that?
I without revealing any names.
Of course, I am
more than okay. So this is a CEO of a little less than 1,000 people. I came in as a referral. So we started talking and we were going kind of back and forth whether or not to do coaching for like 6 months, right? And then he finally decided, okay, let's try. And I said, no, we're not gonna try. Our 1 hour a week is gonna be sacred time. That's the only way we do it. So, okay, fine. So we begin doing it, and I kind of he gets stuck, right? So he's trying to do something, but he's overwhelmed, and he's on the phone, and there's like a lot of these things. And I am okay. Well, what is happening? Well, let's try this. Let's try this. Well, let's talk about this. And kind of going through the motions. And I think fourth or fifth session, we just begin and say, hey. For the past how many years you've been the CEO, in your day-to-day, are you focusing, are you optimizing the present or trying to create a new future for your company? Like, where is your focus? And he says, oh, I don't know. Like, I guess I'm 50-50. Let's find out. For the next 7 days or 10, I think it was 7 days or 2 weeks. I think it was, 2 weeks. Next 2 weeks, whenever you're at work, open up just an Excel spreadsheet and write in, this is what I did, and this is how much time I spent on it, however small it was. But you gotta do everything. Like, oh, Mario, I'll write everything. So next 2 weeks, he just writes it everything. Literally everything, like it's pages and pages of what this guy does. And after he does it, it's like, okay, well, now what are the things that, you're optimizing the present, optimizing the past, right? Focusing on the future. And he goes 90-10 on optimizing the present. There's your
source. There you go.
There's a source of your frustration.
There you
because
go.
Because you have two or three big projects, but they're not getting off the ground because you are constantly putting out fires.
That's right. That's right.
So the way we solved it, and this is, I do hope that a CEO facing a similar thing will maybe solve this situation for him or her, is after we did that, we said, okay, what is absolutely necessary you do? What can you give it to your assistant? What can you delegate to your executive team? And what can you get rid of? And we did it in his 11-hour days. became a manageable 9 per day.
Right.
That's and right. I was like, wow.
I love that.
So much clutter.
I know. I love that idea that you just shared with us, you know, focusing on the present versus the future for a CEO. It's a pullback. It's like you're being pulled back to from where your objective should supposed to be. It depends on the CEO, depends on the objective, obviously. There's a lot of pros and there's a lot of, you know, specifics around that. But in this, if you're trying to move a company forward and you're cool, you know, constantly being pulled back, how can you move forward? And you know, very valid point. And this goes to, and I've seen this pattern before, you know, this whole philosophy of somebody being a manager versus a doer. And, you know, we're all human. And at the end of the day, you see something that needs to be fixed. Your first instinct is to step in and you fix it, even though you've got a million people that can fix it for you. But your first instinct is for you to do it. And I think a lot of people, even, you know, CEOs or non-CEOs, they struggle with that. And I think that's part of that. Do you think?
Yeah. I would say the best ones, the best CEO, the most efficient ones are, again, relentless about who they are spending their time with in and out of work, but also managing their calendar.
Yeah.
Who gets on my time? Who gets on my calendar?
Yeah. And what do you think, Mario, like for, you know, I've worked, you know, with in my past with CEOs that they're very obsessed with the detail, like so detail oriented, like they go down the detail level, like line by line on everything. Like, what do you stand on this one from an executive coach perspective? How do you advise your CEOs for that? Stay high level, go down the layer of details, or dive right into it?
Oh, I would just ask, what purpose does this serve? You being and spending so much time being detail oriented, is it your, you know, is it your obsessive compulsive behavior? Is it you know, your OCD, or is it the need for control? Like, where is this coming from? Like, let me try to explain this to me.
Yeah.
Like, why are you focusing so much on these details? And then again, can we get it someone who can do it at 90% efficiency? If someone can do it at 90% efficiency, you're good, man. Like, you are okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to move on a little bit to hear your theory on, let's say a company that you're working with, a C-level that you're working with, and they're faced with a decision of buying something. And there is somebody who's trying to sell to them from the outside. Have you been through that situation? Like, what is important to the from a C-level perspective, from a CEO or a VP level, when faced with a decision of procurement, like buying a system or buying a brand new billing system or whatever the service that you're trying to contemplate buying, you've been on the inside. How do they think? How do they behave? What is it that they're looking for to hear from a salesperson? You know, are they looking for a certain way to behave from a salesperson? You know, presentation style, prices, etc. So, can you walk us through that thinking process on the inside?
Well, the first thing, and I've been on both sides, right? Like, I've been in the inside, but I'm also, my entire life, whenever I was either a VP sales or CRO, I just ran enterprise motions. So I sold into big companies, more or less complex systems, most of my sales life. So the number one thing, so if you're looking at CEO perspective, number one thing is whatever my company's trying to buy, if it's this big, first of all, I wanna see how my executives think. So I need to do a sanity check there. So if that passes muster, then how strategic is this buy for the future of the company, right? So these guys don't think in you know, January, February, March, or even Q1, Q2, Q3. These guys think in 3 to 5, 10 years. So if I get this big system, and I'm, look, Robin, obviously here we're talking about, you know, 6 and 7 figure deals that will like completely change the organization, right? That's what we're talking about. So what is the strategic long-term benefit from the company? Now, you know, really depending on how good your relationship building skills are as a salesman, can you cover all of the executives? Can you show to the executives both the long-term vision, short-term profitability, saving money, making money, you know, quantifying pain and all of those things? You will be more or less successful. But the one thing that most sellers, and this is, you know, this is what I teach CROs, surprisingly small number of them know this or apply, shocking, is, I know, the intercompany politics. So how do you, as a enterprise seller or a, someone who sells into these big companies, how do you manage intercompany politics? This plays huge roles. Where does the budget come from? Do we want to do something, you know, from the inside? Does someone has a mandate either to buy or solve this problem? And if yes, what's the budget? And do they want to do it in-house? Maybe they want to do it via mergers and acquisitions? Do they want to just buy it plain and simple? And then every one of these, you know, C-level people, they do have their own jobs, hence their own agendas. Not saying they're not aligned, but more often than not, they're not aligned. Like you'd be surprised. So my advice to salespeople is, especially if you're running enterprise motions, yeah, you gotta know multi-thread. You gotta know your, you know, basic mutual action plans. You gotta know all of those things. But man, if you're not good at influencing politics, especially interdepartment politics, when selling like this big of a software, you're not going to succeed, most likely.
And you know, while we're on the topic, or you know, my industry is the localization industry. And the saying goes for those Fortune 500 is that the localization buy as a service does not rise to the top level of the company, like, because of the dollar amount. So if you're talking about a multi-billion dollar company and you're talking about localization budget of, let's say, $5 million, then you're talking about equal to what you would spend at, you know, Staples or Grand & Toy for whatever, you know, pencils. Yeah. And I would assume at that level, it doesn't rise all the way to the top of the company, but the decision to buy, I'm assuming this stays in the middle management, director level, you know, local VP, that kind of thing, I'm assuming. Can you correct me on that one? Does the price tag of the item being bought?
Well, or yeah, the larger the price tag, the more up you need to go, definitely. That was kind of true always. In recent years, I would say post-COVID, even for the quote-unquote smaller deals, so below 100K, CFO gets involved. Now, this wasn't true before COVID, right? So CFOs wouldn't touch anything, you know, below. But now even the ones below 100K, CFO gets involved. So my advice is, you know, cover all of your bases. Know who's making a decision around what. What is their agenda? What is their issues and problems? And then solve it.
This is typical strategic-based selling. That's what you're talking about, right? So you got like the economic buyer.
Yes. Yeah. Miller Heiman, again, I would say one of the best methodologies if you're running enterprise sales, right? Mm-hmm. Strategic selling. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of woven into like a lot of different methodologies. I both, and this will sound weird, but I both love and hate sales methodologies.
Well, sometimes you need to know it to break it, right?
Yeah. Oh, excellent. So the reason why I say it like this is I love them because it gives us structure and it gives us flow and it gives us, okay, how do I run this? But I hate them because it can make salespeople lazy. So every company is different. Every market is different. Every sale is different. So if you are not developing something inside that perfectly fits what you're doing and Robin, both you and I know almost no one does that. They're just, let's put in Medic. Let's put in mutual action plans. Let's put in multi-threading, you know. All
of I know.
strategic selling. But that is the hallmark of a true revenue executive. Absolutely. I will build something that fits my company, my industry, my people, and the product that I'm selling, or the product that we are trying to sell.
That's right. Hey, Mario, I want to ask you, like, there's a lot of, you know, when it comes to revenue generation, and you've been on that side, and you've been a CRO, et cetera, so I'd love to get your opinion on this one. There is the sense of urgency, obviously, and, you know, the clock starts ticking at January 1st, whatever your financial calendar year is. But there is also, which I'm leery of, and I'm very aware of, I hear a lot and I see a lot, sales desperation, I would call them. Like, they're desperate. And they want, and it shows. Like, it's not like very like subtle. It's not subtle. It shows. It's very desperate. How do your clients who are faced with a desperate salesperson react or look at it?
Just ignore.
They ignore, right?
Just ignore. Ignore. I actually had a nice conversation, I think, a couple of weeks ago with one of my clients. And we were, you know, we finished and we kind of began talking. And he says, yeah, I have this like two or three very, you know, persistent salesperson. We kind of get into that. Like, and I immediately go into curious mode. Did they call you? What are the emails that are sending you? What is the messaging? Like, I immediately want to know everything. Like, he's like, all right, Mario, just calm down, right? So he tells me what is happening. Like, man, this is amateur hour. Like, it reeks of the Josh. If you know Josh Brown, a shout out to Josh Brown. He was one of the first people I actually was who influenced the way I sell. He calls it the commission breath, right? Whatever you say, you have the commission breath. You're not here to help, and you can smell it.
Yeah.
Right. As you said, they reek of desperation. Same thing. Right. So, you know, to all of my sales executives and sales friends, if you're not getting replies and you're getting ghosted, you messed up somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. You messed up somewhere. Absolutely.
Messed up somewhere.
Now, throughout your, your coaching career, what impressed you the most? Like, what makes, in your opinion, a good leader versus a great leader? Like, what are the characteristics that you've noticed?
We are talking about sales leadership or, you know, revenue?
In general. CEO, CRO, whatever you want to qualify them.
I would say if I could boil it to two, I would say relentless and then empathy.
Empathy.
Yeah. Yeah. They are relentless in chasing their goals of the company, their personal goals, the goals of the organization. But they also have a lot of empathy towards the people that are around.
They're working with them, huh?
That doesn't mean they will tolerate bad performance. Let's make this very clear. But I would say those two things. As for the executives, right? So this is C-level. I think, especially the CEOs, right? The most important trait is raise the bar. Set the standards. If your standards are low, we have an organizational and cultural problem. But I will stick to relentless and empathy.
Have you seen them in a I guess my second question to that is, being vulnerable as a CEO or as a C-level executive in a large organization, does that help your leadership growth or does it hurt it?
I would say helps 100%, and here's why. You know, we've been through, you know, 90s and early 2000s with the gung-ho, take no prisoners CEOs, you know, that just march through everything, you know, break things and all of that, right?
They called them the disruptors at the time, right?
Well, they did call them the disruptors, right? And some of them succeeded, some of them ended up in jail because, you know, the Theranos and the Enrons of the world, right?
That's right. You're right.
But I would say to every CEO, stop trying to be perfect. You're not, you're human. Let your, especially your executive team, show them, you know, you're human. You will make mistakes. Own your mistakes and move on. Your people will respect you a lot more if you own up to that.
If you own, like, one of the things that probably every CEO is on their mind right now thinking about is that whole new global economy that we're in, and how is that impacting your conversations with your clients? Is it coming to the conversation or not?
Oh, it definitely does. I don't want to go into politics, last things we want to do, but from whatever side of the spectrum, especially when we talk US politics, right? Doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, we can talk about it, we can have civil conversations about it, you know. But the main thing every business needs is a stable environment, is stability, right? The current administration is so unpredictable. It's so kind of hectic and, you know, all over the place. This is not a stable business environment because the budgets get frozen, and the budgets are frozen. There are no big companies are not buying. When big companies are not buying, that means a lot of the smaller ones will just fail, or they will not get any sales in. So it's kind of I'm not an economist, but I definitely, the number one thing that I get is they wish there was more stability, more predictability in what are the policies, how will the economy go, what are the moves that the administration will take. I will say this is number one thing, predictability.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, a business environment requires a stability. Otherwise, you know, that's war pretty much. That's what the uncertainty brings. So before we started the recording, I was making a comment about the books behind you, and you mentioned that there's a lot more books, and you said you read a lot of books.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about, or give advice to the audience, one book that every aspiring leader should read. Which one would you add? Which one would you recommend?
I have it. I don't know if he will listen to this podcast, I do hope, but shout out to the CEO of Arbinger Institute, Mitch Warner. He is the son of late Reverend and Professor Warner, Terry C. Warner.
Okay.
Beginning of 2000, they released a book called Leadership and Self-Deception. What is fascinating about this book is, I think 2006, the year after, sales has grown of this book, which is unprecedented in books. You know, book have released, they peak, and they kind of go down, right? It kind of the curve. Well, with Leadership and Self-Deception, it's the opposite. It just keeps rising and rising and rising. So if you're a leader, if you're a CEO, get everything by Arbinger. So Leadership and Self-Deception. I'll remember the rest of the titles. But this one is by far the best.
That's right. Yeah. Another rapid fire question for you.
Yeah.
Tell me about a myth about coaching that you would like to debunk.
Oh, I have it. Why are coaches not allowed to give advice?
Okay.
Well, it goes to my earlier, you know, earlier comment that today's coaches and today's coaching has its roots in psychology and psychiatry, where you're not allowed to question the reality of the person you're talking. You're not allowed to imprint your own, you know, experiences and values and all as a therapist, right? So it has roots in therapy. But in business coaching, come on. I saw a session once where a CFO trained in one of these methodologies, coaching, was coaching another younger CFO, right?
Okay.
And this young guy, like, he's clearly struggling. And we are going in circles. He's going in circles with power questions, with what do you think? And this guy has no, just give him the damn answer. Like, you know, you've been this in the situations, just give him the answer, man. So, you know, that's a myth. Why are coaches not allowed to? And I'm okay. The majority will say, well, okay, that's not coaching. That's, you know, that's mentoring. That's something. Agree to disagree.
So that's another one for you.
Yeah.
I know you cover, you know, variety of geographical area around the world. I'm assuming your CEOs are distributed around the world. What is your
Europe
personal
and Europe and North America mainly? Yeah.
Yeah. Different time zones, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So what is your personal morning routine and your daily habits that ground you? Because obviously you're coaching others, but you need to, you know, take care of yourself. So how do you take care of yourself? Morning routine and
morning
anything
routine,
that grounds you. What do you do?
I get up, I get in the bathroom, do, you know, the usual morning things. And then I recently started doing this. I begin to stretch. So I stretch between 8 and 10 minutes every morning.
I have that. And I started doing that a few weeks ago, actually a few months ago now. And I love it. I don't do weight. I do a little bit of weights, but I do stretching, quite a bit of stretching, dead hangs, anything.
Yeah, I just do 10 minutes, just basic yoga stretches, nothing too complex. And then I have my first morning coffee. I don't drink, you know, blackety black. I drink a little bit of coffee with a lot of plant milk. So, you know, either almond or coconut or stuff like that. And then I try to write. Not every morning, depending on meetings that I have. But that's kind of been my morning
yeah.
routine.
Yeah.
I say. And I go to the gym 3 times a week. And before I hurt my back, I went golfing 2 times. So I like 5 times a week. Very much physical.
Is there good golf ranges around Berlin?
Oh, lots of them. Yeah, I would. If you're ever around Berlin, ping me and we'll
love that.
Play 18 holes.
Yeah, I would love that. That would be great. Hey, another one for you. I know, like, when you work with customers, some customers gives you feedback. I'm assuming as part of your process to give you feedback.
Yeah, of course.
So, what is the most surprising one? Which one did you receive and you thought, oh wow, this is surprising? If you can share.
I can. It was, well, I'm now fairly long in the industry, and I have an estimation between 3 and 3,500 coaching hours by now, right? But in the beginning, one lady client said to me, I felt you were being too aggressive with me. And I was like, I didn't want to. I'm sorry. Like, it felt like I violated something, right? And I'm really, really cognizant, very careful around those things. Trying to be. So I took that feedback really seriously. And then I you know, try to get what I learned from that is I want to mimic the tempo of the person. So if a person is high energy, I'm going to be high energy. If they're low energy, I'm going to be low energy. You know, I'm trying to match that person's pace, as they say. Because when I ran sales motions, man, and when I ran revenue, I always said, and I always said to my CEOs this, I will walk faster than most of you will run. So you have to be, you know, you got to be careful.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Very early on in my career as a coach, you know, and I began almost 10 years ago, you know, part-time, I did it like that. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't know better.
Mm-hmm.
I was young and stupid.
We all been there, Mario. We all been there, buddy.
Oh, yeah. So, but I think that was the most eye-opening feedback I got.
Yeah. And here's the last one for you. If one of your prospect clients listening to this podcast And, you know, we're going to be recording close to 50 minutes of this conversation. What word do you want them to associate you with? What do you want them to associate you with?
Good question. Can I use two words? Sure, I can.
As many as you want.
There we go. I would say I'll use four. The four would be relentless pursuit of the impossible future. So relentless pursuit, impossible future.
Absolutely. And you know what? That hits home for many people because we're all going through every company around the world today. And I don't believe any company sits idly by today and say, oh, we're successful. We don't need to do anything. Everybody is looking for improvement. Everybody's looking to do better. Everybody's looking to improve what they're doing, either on their stock price or on their profits or on the revenue. It doesn't matter what it is. Operational efficiencies. If everything is running smoothly, they don't need CEOs. They probably that entire layer will go away. The reason you would have these people in their place where they are right now, where they're operating right now, leading these companies, is because you want to move to the next level. Is always you need to look forward to the next level.
Yeah.
Am I correct?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now that we've almost reached the end of this, what do you think of this conversation we've had so far? I mean, we've been talking for almost 47 minutes. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I love talking about this. This has been my passion. I always kind of, even in my early beginnings, and I began in sales, you know, when I was a teenager selling, you know, Oriflame and Avon in the 90s. But even in the beginning of 2000s, when I was a little bit more mature and began, I always wanted to teach others. I wanted to be this supporting teacher that will help them be the best version of themselves. I didn't know how to formulate it, you know, be the best version of themselves. I just wanted to help them be successful and you know, achieve their goals. And whenever running sales teams or working with clients or running big revenue teams, I always wanted my people to be successful.
Absolutely.
That's that.
You absolutely correct. And you sound like you're passionate about what you're doing. That's what I love about this. It's like the passion that you exhibit when you talk about this topic.
One of my good buddies, and if he is listening, shout out to Christian Redick, one of the best CROs. I learned so much from him. One of the best CROs out there. He called me like big rolling ball of energy. So sometimes I do need like, and one of my CEOs 10 years ago told me, Mario, you're an acquired taste.
You're an acquired taste?
I'm an acquired taste. You know, some executives just don't, you know, I'm not a fit with everyone, which is completely okay and completely normal, right? Like, we are not a fit with everyone, but the ones that I am a fit with, that's...
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you for joining me today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I wish we can do it again.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, we can. No problem. I'm happy to reprise.
Maybe next time what we'll do, we'll focus on a specific subject matter.
Sure. Sure.
And then we'll dive into it.
Yeah. Awesome. Love it.
I really love the opportunity that we've had today to our conversation. Thank you so much, Mario, joining me all the way from Berlin. Hopefully it's not like, what is it, 9 o'clock for you right now?
It's 9 o'clock, yeah.
I'm sorry to keep you waiting for 9 o'clock. It's Friday. Hopefully I'm the last call between you and the bar, I hope. Or
no,
a beer?
I don't go out. I'll just be on my couch, and you know, kids are out, wife is with a friend, so I have the house all to myself.
There you go. It's alone time. It's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. Alone time. Yeah.
I really appreciate the call. Thank you so much for the conversation. For our audience, thank you for listening in on this episode, and thank you for joining me for however you choose to join us through YouTube, through our podcast, through our blog site, and through our short videos that we publish for every one of these episodes. We publish close to about a dozen short videos on YouTube. If you guys want to engage with the content, we appreciate this. And just a reminder to everybody, the Localization Fireside Chat is a personal initiative started by me. It's not supported by anybody. It's not funded by anybody. It's not sponsored by anybody. This is just me who loves to talk to people such as Mario, who joined me today, and other guests that have joined me over the past 2 years they've started this initiative. I love these conversations. I love being in dialogue with people in various types of businesses, various types of ideas, and bring them in to the localization fireside chat to amplify what they do, their thoughts, and their creativity. So thanks again for joining me. I appreciate it and look forward to another conversation or another episode.